You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the March 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's this month's cover story, Thoroughly Modern Millie. As the sensational hit series that launched her career comes to an end, Millie Bobby Brown has a plan to sustain the momentum, all while saying no as much as he needs to and living on a farm in Georgia. Why not? Stranger Things Have Happened by Susie Exposito, with photos by Solvi Sunspo, styled by George Cortina. Millie Bobby Brown was photographed December 16th in New York City. Millie Bobby Brown was 11 when she began playing the icon known as Eleven. By the time she shot her final scenes as her fierce, loyal, and telekinetic characters on Stranger Things this past December, she was 20, newly married, and living on a farm in Georgia. Some days, she bottle-fed a baby goat in her trailer. Many days, she brought her foster dogs to work, which the cast and crew lovingly welcomed. There was also a lot of Wicked, I'm a Big Musical Girl, Brown says, which the show's creators recall a little less tenderly. She asked us to play Defying Gravity while she was hovering midair in a harness so she could pretend to fly like Elphaba, says Matt Duffer, who created the show with his brother Ross. Not just because she loves the song, but because she knows it drives us a little crazy. But the bosses forgave her fast. As soon as the camera rolls, barely a second before, that silliness vanishes and she just transforms into Eleven. Now that Stranger Things has wrapped up, the final season will air this year, Brown is cruising at a very comfortable altitude. She has a beloved role on her resume that isn't likely to weigh her down or define her in the 60 or so years she has left as an actor, if she goes full on Dame Judi Dench. Yes, the show has been one of the biggest phenomenons of the streaming era. Yes, it's the answer to the question, how did Netflix survive 2022 when nearly a million subscribers jumped ship? And yes, Brown was the series' first breakout star, and Eleven arguably its most indelible creation. But the actor also has a beauty and lifestyle brand called Florence by Mills, an animal rescue organization named Joey's Friends, which she runs from the farm, a successful, well-loved Sherlockian film franchise in Netflix's Enola Holmes, and a gripping new sci-fi movie called The Electric State, which was directed by the Russo brothers, and in which she stars as a spunky grunge heroine thrown into a war between robots and the humans who created them. In other words, she's not likely to be pigeonholed, and she definitely won't get bored. The combination of Brown's youth and the rate of her ascendancy, as well as the noxious combination of vile men and the internet, have made for some rough terrain, and during our interviews, she will be honest with me about how they've infuriated and affected her. Chris Pratt, who stars with her in The Electric State, tells me she's authentic and tough. She's not a pleaser. She's very capable of charm, but it's not her only weapon. She has a point of view and strength that are incredibly watchable. And again, with the critters, she had a different rescue animal on set every day. Brown's sprawling farm lies at the end of a winding back road in rural Georgia, behind a thicket of pines. When I pull up to the property on a Tuesday afternoon, she emerges from a stable to greet me with her husband, Jake Bon Jovi, an actor, producer, and a son of John Bon Jovi. The couple gave love a good name at a small ceremony in May of last year and had a second, bigger wedding in Tuscany in September. Today, Brown is fresh-faced, wearing a plaid button-down, jeans, and pearl earrings. She introduces me to an assortment of sheep, goats, cows, donkeys, and a slinky tuxedo cat who sits on a fence post so he can play with the horses. As it happens, Brown's therapy dog, Winnie, sits in one of the house's windows. The actor adopted her 5 years ago to help ease her panic attacks. But at the moment, Winnie is flailing her paws at the window in a codependent frenzy and seems in need of some emotional support herself. Winnie is a really good set dog, Brown says. If I'm fake crying, she doesn't get stressed. But when she knows I'm real crying, she gets stressed. She can tell the difference. Brown did some real crying during the final season of Stranger Things, in part because of rain. It was a logistically taxing shoot. We did tonight's work last night, and last night's work is going to happen tonight. It's so complicated. But by the time she shot her penultimate scene, the gravity of the series coming to a close really struck her. It wasn't hitting me this entire time until yesterday, Brown says. I was on set, and I was like, well, I have one more day left. And I started crying. I don't actually like to cry at work. I'm a really emotional person, but I try to stay super strong. It made me feel so uncomfortable. Jake was like, it's good, you have to get it out. And I just started welling up. Brown's mother and father are British, but she was born in Marbella, Spain, where they had moved to be close to her dad's parents, who'd settled there. As a very young child, she had already demonstrated a zest for show tunes. When the family returned to the UK, Brown enrolled in classes for acting, singing, and dancing. Her father, Robert, worked in real estate at the time. Her mother, Kelly, was a stay-at-home parent. My dream was to be Hannah Montana, she says. I loved Hairspray and Mamma Mia. When Brown was 8, the family moved again, this time to Orlando, where her parents launched a teeth whitening business. After her acting started to gain momentum, they moved to Hollywood to support her nascent career, and she landed bit parts on NCIS, Modern Family, and Grey's Anatomy. But the opportunity stopped knocking, and they returned to the UK. Brown's parents urged her to make an audition tape for Stranger Things before she gave up all hope. In 2015, she landed the role of a psychokinetic child raised in a laboratory, named after the number tattooed on her wrist and befriended by neighborhood kids. Apart from nailing the great Goonies' inflected eccentricities core to Stranger Things' success, Brown managed to capture the clumsy inelegance of real-life adolescence while simultaneously undergoing it. I implemented what I was learning as a child, or what I was going through, into her, she says. Eleven's identity was a huge thing that we were kind of fighting with. Is she going to dress as a girl? Or is she going to dress in the shirts of her adoptive father, Hopper? Or is she going to be what her friends are helping her to be? At that time in my life, I didn't know what I wanted to look like, if I preferred more feminine looks, more masculine looks, more androgynous, more grunge. So I implemented that confusion. Brown quickly started diversifying her work to ensure that her career would outlast her phenomenal breakthrough. Her business endeavors often nod to her family. In a sense, they're a reminder of how hard child stars work, not just for their futures, but on behalf of the people they love. When she was 15, Brown co-founded Florence by Mills, a Gen Z forward brand that offers skincare products and loungewear named after her great-grandmother, who had a similarly independent spirit, according to family lore. When she was 19, she co-authored her first novel, 19 Steps, inspired by stories her grandmother Ruth told her about the horrific Bethnal Green tube disaster of World War II. When 173 people were killed in the crush to seek shelter from an air raid. Even the name of Brown's production company, PCMA, is composed of the first initials of the Brown siblings, according to birth order, Paige, Charlie, Millie, Ava. On top of starring in the ongoing Enola Holmes franchise, Enola is the younger sister of the title to Henry Cavill's wavy-haired Sherlock. She made 2024's Damsel, inverting the woman in distress trope with a quiver full of arrows and a thirst for revenge, co-starring Robin Wright and Angela Bassett. The movie was number one on Netflix in 79 countries. So Brown is poised to have a very strong solo career once she definitively leaves a great pop band that is Stranger Things, starting with the Electric State. But she'll be taking some scars on the journey, the result of having been famous and female so young. On a precious day off, and to be fair, it's not really a day off because she's talking to me, Brown and I catch up on a video call. She's sitting in her kitchen. Her shoulders are tense, and her answers seem wary. Brown pushes back on several questions about growing up with her castmates, reluctant to get drawn into something she believes could be a drama spiral. I don't allow many people into my life, and when I do, I think it should be super moderated, she says. I started this really young, and I felt that the press specifically was very, very harsh on me, and so I just like to be sure that I'm advocating for myself. Brown has real reason for her aversion. Early on in Stranger Things' run, faceless fans online began dissecting the body language between Brown and her co-stars when they did interviews, then inventing feuds and sexual tensions among the very young teens. When Brown's castmate, Finn Wolfhard, who plays Eleven's best friend turned beau, Mike Wheeler, was 14, he publicly pleaded for people to leave them alone after one too many run-ins with intrusive adults in public. If you are for real, you will not harass my friends or coworkers, he wrote in a now-deleted post from 2017. At 13, while Brown was in the midst of a fashion shoot in Australia, a rogue paparazzo snuck onto the closed set and snapped invasive voyeuristic shots of her, which were published the next day. Brown's slight English accent emerges when she says of one photo, "I didn't have nothing on underneath. It wasn't too much, but it was enough for it not to be okay." I think, just in general, there should be more laws with the media in terms of paparazzi, in terms of exploitation. As Brown got older, she was increasingly sexualized online and no longer felt the internet was a safe place to engage with fans. The cumulative invasions of her privacy, she says, warped her own body image in ways she still grapples with, and she removed social media from her phone at 18. I was like, oh my goodness, this is making me feel horrible about myself, she says. I deleted it because I was becoming way too obsessed with the idea of becoming someone else. Over the years, there have also been snarky headlines about what Brown has gotten paid. Though the numbers sound reasonable in the context of the industry, her own popularity, and the enormous success of her projects. Netflix reportedly was paying her approximately $250,000 an episode by the third season of Stranger Things. In 2019, the streamer reportedly gave her $10 million for her second installment of Enola Holmes, which was apparently the highest upfront salary ever for an actor under 20. Today, Brown says she's always felt protected by her parents and by Netflix, too. She points out that contracts she signed as a child should never have been leaked, but instead should have been protected so that they're not on the record. She adds, it just puts children in a really dangerous situation. All the scrutiny has made her keen to tackle the treatment of women and kids in the entertainment business. I think everybody's a little bit too lax about the way that children are brought up in the industry, she says. I grew up with a lot of eyes on my parents, but I feel that those were the people that protected me the most. I learned how to say no at a very young age, she continues. I think it's a very powerful word. My mom is very knowing and wise, and she advocates for herself. My dad has always been someone who pushes me to stand up for myself and never settle for anything less than what I deserve. The trust he's instilled in me, the love and hope he's instilled in me, has helped me go on sets or stages and fight for myself in hopes that I can fight for others. I never wanted to be famous, she adds. That was never my thing. I just love acting. Brown considers herself an extrovert, but keeps to a small circle of friends. She says that growing up in a bubble with her Stranger Things castmates limited her social development. They were schooled privately on set. They played games together between shoots. But then COVID isolated them even further, and eventually they grew into their respective acting careers. Brown and Bon Jovi socialize in New York from time to time with Stranger Things star Noah Schnapp. She had been photographed in L.A. with two of Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt's children, Zahara and Shiloh Jolie. But lately, Brown feels happiest communing with her fauna on the farm. I don't have many friends because of who I am, she says. I didn't go to school, so I don't have the best social skills when it comes to people my own age and friendships. I struggle with that quite a bit. I missed out on a few things, but I'm working through them. In a world that demands a constant churn of digital engagement from entertainers and erodes the boundaries between the internet and reality, there is something about Brown's pastoral life that seems aspirational. These days, she barely checks her phone and largely delegates social media duties, though she's aware of what will be posted. Brown's familiar with the contrived tradwife fantasies being sold on TikTok and other platforms, but that's not what inspired her more analog life. I'm not doing it for the aesthetic, she says. I'm doing it because I love it. There are maybe some tradwives out there doing it because it seems wholesome, but it is not. If you're not picking up horse shit or washing a cow with your bare hands, then that life is not made for you at all. During my first visit to her farm, Brown gives me a tour of a cozy barn where she houses dogs rescued from local kill shelters. The goal is that they will all be available for adoption through Joey's friends. One of the dogs is a chunky bulldog named Mama, whom Brown had transferred from Yogi's house, the animal rescue actor Nicola Peltz-Beckham helps run. Mama happens to have her own tiny treadmill in her pen and a small television affixed to the wall, which plays a flickering Yule log. Brown is well aware of how funny that looks to an outsider. Mama got donations from Nicola's fans, she says with a laugh. A couple of years ago, Brown enrolled in online courses at Purdue University, where she studied human services because she wanted to deepen her expertise as a UNICEF Goodwill ambassador. After launching her animal rescue in 2022, she also began taking classes in veterinary studies. She even bought an ultrasound machine to learn how to scan animals for pregnancy. I'm able to treat wounds, take their pulse, moderate blood pressure, things like that. I do all their medical records myself, she says. Now I just have to do my externship, which is like sitting in on surgeries and things like that. Adoption campaigns on social media are wonderful temporarily, but you really have to get in there and do the work to make a difference. Brown's pursuit of a slower life dovetails with her role in The Electric State. In the movie, she plays Michelle, an orphaned 90s-era teen desperate to find her brilliant long-lost brother. With help from a goofy smuggler played by Pratt, she inadvertently joins a resistance movement led by robots, who rally against the very tech overlords who created and exploited them. Before signing on for the role, Brown visited the Russo brothers on set while they made 2019's Avengers Endgame. There's not a lot of teenage girls who have the depth of acting experience that Millie has, says Anthony Russo, who directed four Marvel movies with his brother, Joe, before taking on The Electric State. We needed somebody who's a supremely skilled, trained, talented actor at a young age. Millie is uniquely positioned in that place because of the vast amount of work she's been able to do. The movie is set in what Russo calls a 1990s that never existed, perhaps in part to lay down epic needle drops by Judas Priest and Danzig, and raises questions about our ability to stay connected as humans without falling back on AI and other rapidly advancing technology that would let us live our lives by proxy. We do feel like the fantasy space is a great space to process difficult things, says Russo. We're in a period of exciting possibilities, where technology can connect us to other human beings in ways that it never could before. But it's also creating dangers, addictions, and questionable behavior between people. Schools are just getting to the place right now where they're starting to ban cell phones. As a sci-fi star who has resisted the quicksand of the internet as much as she can, Brown channels some of her real-life angst and bleeding heart into her role as a dauntless young Luddite. It just aligned with everything I was looking for, she says. I visit Brown a second time at the farm and find her lounging on a sofa in what she calls her she shed. It also happens to be the headquarters for Joey's friends, which explains why there are metal cabinets full of medical records and wooden shelves stocked with gauze, latex gloves, and antiseptics. Evermore, Brown's favorite Taylor Swift album, plays softly in the background as a rainstorm ambiently hisses outside. Brown herself is much more at ease and forthcoming than on our video call. She tells me about seeing Swift on the Cincinnati stop on the now legendary Eras Tour. Brown's a longtime Swiftie, and she and Bon Jovi have learned the live choreography to I Can Do It With a Broken Heart. It was amazing. It was unbelievable, she says. At Sabrina Carpenter's concert in Atlanta, Brown was famously sighted on the arena video display, where the singer staged one of her arrest routines with her. Carpenter has since done the bit with Grammy-winning producer Jack Antonoff and his wife, the Substance star Margaret Qualley, and Saturday Night Live comedian Marcello Hernandez as his SNL character Domingo. Brown confesses that she messaged Carpenter before the show with a cheeky request, "Can you arrest me?" To which the espresso singer responded, "I would love to arrest you." Brown still has an inkling of a dream to record an album or star in a Broadway musical, but says the demands of touring and daily performances would be difficult to balance with her animal rescue work. Still, she realized her musical dreams during her second, more lavish wedding ceremony in September, where she and Bon Jovi celebrated their nuptials by performing a medley of songs from Greece. It's a 5-6 minute dance routine that we choreographed ourselves, she tells me giddily. They kicked it off with Summer Nights, then pivoted to You're the One That I Want, and we go together. There were even costume changes. We started with leather jackets and glasses, then took them off, she says. I was in my Sandy jumpsuit, and he was in this cool T-shirt, pants, and really shiny shoes. Matthew Modine, who plays Dr. Martin Papa Brenner on Stranger Things, officiated the wedding. It was absolutely sublime, he says. I was surprised how emotional I became during the vows. I'd been witness to so much of Millie's private life and her professional career, and I'd seen her grow from that adorable child into a beautiful and thoughtful adult. I was with her when she first met young Jake. And now she's beginning a whole new life with such a kind man. Bon Jovi is an actor, too. Last year, he appeared in the comedy Rock Bottom and the teen rom-com Sweethearts, in which he parodied hair rockers of his dad's generation. Despite growing up a superstar son in New York City and New Jersey, Bon Jovi has eased into life on the farm and is often at Brown's side as they tend to the animals. Brown and Bon Jovi were young when they got married, 20 and 22 respectively, but Brown speaks with a clarity that feels rare in this age of gamified dating and the illusion of infinite options online. We were pretty united going into it, she says of Bon Jovi, whom she met through mutual friends. We talked about our political views, what kind of family we want to build, the kind of home we want to live in, the kind of relationship we're looking for, the kind of careers we want. It's such an important decision, and we wanted to make sure we were making the right one. I knew I was. It always felt right with him. Both sets of parents served as positive examples. The Browns married in their early 20s, and the Bon Jovis were high school sweethearts who married on a whim in Vegas when they were both in their 20s. The Bon Jovis' New Jersey wit gels well with her British family, she says, and they enjoy riotous laughter at dinners all together. Ask what lessons she's learned from marriage. Brown sinks into the plush corner of her sofa in the she shed and thinks for a moment. Loving someone and being in love are two different things, she says. I think I loved a lot of people I was with, like I loved my friends. But he is the first man I've ever loved and been in love with. If we're not fully invested, then what's the point? We have to be, and we always have been. Brown tells me that she and Bon Jovi hope to develop films that amplify the stories that are not represented in Hollywood. Jake's passion is creating stories that ultimately empower people, she says. He shares such a similar goal to me in that. I want others to be able to watch my projects and feel empowered and feel like someone is rooting for them. At the moment, Brown is cooking up the third installment of her Enola Holmes series and will continue to grow her animal rescue operation. Her idyllic life in the countryside is clearly bustling. You think animals are peaceful, she says. You think the South is peaceful. You think this place is peaceful, but there's so much chaos. My animals are loud and it's messy, and my dogs are crazy. And there is, you know, laughter and a lot of passion and excitement, and it is a very vibrant place. There is so much chaos, and that is where I thrive. NYPD Confidential. Along with a contingent of detectives and undercover operatives, the NYPD's counter-terror czar, Rebecca Weiner, defends New York City and the nation against enemies foreign and domestic. Adam Ciralski reports from inside the country's most elite local law enforcement agency, with photographs by Mark Seliger. Opening photo, Rebecca's Bureau. The NYPD's Deputy Commissioner of Intelligence and Counterterrorism, Rebecca Weiner, with officers from her 1,600-member squad in Brooklyn Bridge Park. On a cloudless September afternoon, I stopped by One Police Plaza in Lower Manhattan to see Rebecca Ulam Weiner, an enigmatic figure who occupies one of the most consequential and improbable perches in America's national security hierarchy. As the NYPD's Deputy Commissioner of Intelligence and Counterterrorism, her chief mission is to counter terrorism and mitigate targeted violence, fight crime, and protect people, places, and events in New York City. And that's not the half of it. As part of her sprawling portfolio, the 47-year-old mother of two relies on a mind-boggling suite of assets that Americans might otherwise assume are controlled by the CIA, FBI, DHS, Secret Service, or other agencies. Weiner has access to a legion of intelligence and analyst, counter-assault, and dignitary protection teams, a flotilla of boats, radiation-sniffing and surveillance aircraft, the nation's biggest bomb squad, a counter-drone unit, a remote contingent of NYPD detectives stationed in 13 cities overseas, and a network of multilingual undercover operatives who subvert malicious actors across the U.S. and around the world. Dubbed Intel, or ICB for short, the Intelligence and Counterterrorism Bureau was forged from the fires of 9/11. For more than a decade, its members drew scorn from and fought turf wars with America's spooks and special agents. But after helping foil more than 60 terrorist plots, Weiner's squad has made a quantum leap from deeply controversial to positively indispensable. NYPD intel disrupts terror attacks, runs deep undercover operations, and disseminates threat assessments and flash reports to its sister agencies, as well as foreign intelligence services, offering expertise and muscle for cases as varied as mystery drones flying over the tri-state area and December's fatal shooting of United Healthcare CEO in Midtown Manhattan. On August 1st, I approached Weiner's team with the idea of chronicling its operations. Just on the horizon loomed the annual 9/11 commemoration, the first anniversary of Hamas's October 7th attack on Israel, and the violence and upheaval it wrought, and a highly contentious U.S. election. The NYPD agreed, citing the volume of threats facing New York and the country, and the department's unique role in combating them. When I arrive at her 11th floor office, Weiner was sporting a baby blue pin on her lapel, a vestige of the September 11th ceremony at the World Trade Center memorial she had attended and helped secured earlier in the day. Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, and the men pining for their jobs, Donald Trump and J.D. Vance, were there. Responsibility for their safety that morning fell in part to Weiner. Though fierce political foes, the four principals were united by the occasion's solemnity. They were also defiant in their decision to stand together on the proverbial X, what security specialists refer to as a position of maximum vulnerability. It wasn't political theater. Weeks earlier, an assassin had shot at Trump at a rally in Butler, Pennsylvania, killing a spectator, and 4 days later, a second gunman would be caught fleeing Trump's golf club in West Palm Beach. As we sat in her inner sanctum, surrounded by diplomas, Harvard College, Harvard Law, assorted law enforcement tchotchkes, and her young kids' artwork, events in Ukraine and the Middle East conspire to make it feel as though the world were spinning off its axis. At the same moment, three floors above, her boss, Police Commissioner Edward Cabin, was about to resign under pressure from his boss, Mayor Eric Adams, who would soon be indicted. Shortly thereafter, Cabin's replacement, Tom Danlin, would fall under federal investigation as well. The machinations inside the cloistered halls of 1PP and Gracie Mansion, however, paled in comparison to what was happening on the streets. An ISIS-inspired plot to murder Jews in Brooklyn had just been stymied. That was on the heels of arrest in New York, L.A., and Philly of a group of Tajik men with alleged ISIS ties who had come across the Mexican border. Meanwhile, Weiner and her team were on the lookout for Iranian agents prowling the city and actively planning to assassinate dissidents and former U.S. officials, Trump among them, in a series of overlapping plots, revealed here in minute detail for the first time. All of this was happening against the backdrop of an election and a poisonous political atmosphere that had drawn an alphabet soup of wingnuts, including what those in counter-terror circles refer to as racially, ethnically motivated violent extremist, or RIMVI, homegrown violent extremist, HVE, and anti-government, anti-authority violent extremist, AGAVI. The variety of threats that we have right now, Weiner observed, are unprecedented in the 20 years I've been in this work. Whether they know it or not, New Yorkers and Americans across the land are now standing on the X. In no small measure, safeguarding America's financial and cultural capital and its 8 million residents rest on the shoulders of a 5-foot, 5-inch national security prodigy with a backstory that is the stuff of cinema. If you didn't have a Rebecca Weiner, you would have had to make her up, her predecessor John Miller told me, how her life has come full circle. The H-bomb and its fallout. Weiner grew up in a family steeped in secrets and service. In 1939, her grandfather, Stanislaw Ulam, enticed by a teaching offer from Harvard, fled Poland ahead of the Nazi invasion. Soon enough, he was contacted by the renowned mathematician John von Neumann, who suggested that Ulam relocate with his wife to New Mexico for war work. But did not and could not explain anything more. Knowing nothing about the place, my grandfather checked out a library book on the American Southwest, Weiner recounted, as we raced along the Franklin D. Roosevelt Drive in a blacked-out Suburban. Based on who had checked out the book before him, he figured out that the U.S. was working on a fission device. Her grandparents moved to Los Alamos in the early days of the top-secret Manhattan Project, so early, in fact, that Weiner's mother, Claire, was among the first babies born on the hill, as Los Alamos was euphemistically known. There, Ulam collaborated closely with Edward Teller on the hydrogen bomb, which cycled through various nicknames, including the Super, Ivy Mike, and the Teller-Ulam design. Ulam's contributions to America's national defense were extraordinary. Not only did he co-develop a weapon so destructive that scientists and policymakers believed its mere existence would help ensure the peace amid a very cold war, but he was also the brains behind Orion, an Elon Musk-sounding endeavor to harness nuclear pulse propulsion to slingshot rocket ships into deep space. Weiner remembered how her grandfather's achievements at work did not always sit well at home. She said her grandmother, a French émigré whom she called Mémé, grew disenchanted with America's ongoing nuclear enterprise in the wake of the devastating A-bomb attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. In short, it seems that what her grandfather considered elegant solutions to thorny math and physics problems, his wife viewed as unacceptable or at least troubling, moral choices. While a Harvard undergrad, Weiner studied the impact that women had on the Manhattan Project, and last year wrote about her family's unique dynamic and dilemmas. Meme vividly recounted the moment she came across my grandfather sitting in the kitchen one day, staring blindly into their garden. "I found a way to make it work," he said. "It's a totally different scheme, and it will change the course of history." Pulling no punches, Weiner noted when the U.S. tested Ivy Mike, the first hydrogen bomb built using the new design, it vaporized an entire South Pacific island. In our conversations, it was evident that the New Mexico native has internalized the lessons of her lineage. She needs no reminder that with great power comes great responsibility. In a way, she is so laser-focused, she seems unfazed by the internecine battles of New York City or NYPD politics. In November, she learned she would be reporting to her third police commissioner in 2 months. Her close friend, Jessica Tisch, heir to the Lowe's fortune, who has 3 degrees from Harvard and a background in counterterrorism. Given the relentless pace and tremendous stakes of Weiner's job, I was also struck by her breezy demeanor and wicked sense of humor. She burst out laughing when I asked her to comment on Miller's observation about her. "Somewhere there's a strange corollary between building the bomb that was meant to bring peace in the Manhattan Project to being in charge of the project that keeps bombs out of a place called Manhattan." Ribbing her friend and former boss, she replied, "That's the insight you have as you're eating Cool Ranch Doritos after smoking way too much pot." Ruminating further on the historical and personal through line, Weiner said, "I like the leitmotif. Yeah, they did think it was going to end war. Well, hopefully I will have more success keeping the bombs out of Manhattan than the Manhattan Project had making a bomb to keep peace forevermore." Such offhand acuity is part of her makeup. Weiner is poised, cultivated, pin sharp, convivial, boundlessly curious, charmingly profane, a lightning quick study, and at times a person possessed. At one point, as we discussed her unit's close cooperation with Scotland Yard, I learned that she had spent 18 years helping bring to justice a seemingly untouchable ISIS recruiter in the UK. When I asked a top U.S. diplomat for his read on Weiner, he called her the real deal, an assessment based in no small measure on where he's run into her at national security conferences. "When I hit the hotel gym at 5:30 in the morning," he said, "she's always there on the treadmill. Only the two of us and maybe one other guy. She's totally hardcore." NYPD stealth. As America's gateway, New York City has long welcomed those wishing to join our democratic experiment and defended against those seeking to destroy it. That was foremost on my mind in late September when I went with Weiner and her associates on some unconventional ride-alongs as New York played host to the single largest gathering of world leaders, heads of state, monarchs, and their retinues, all of whom had come to town for the annual United Nations General Assembly, or UNGA. It is a diplomatic spectacle wrapped in a security nightmare. Allies and adversaries arrive on a flock of official planes, swarm the city's hotels, and move between meetings and meals in convoys flanked by the Threat Assessment and Protective Unit, TAPU. All under Weiner's and now Tisch's command. "We're running 215 motorcades today," said Greg Engel, the gregarious silver-haired lieutenant who has been choreographing the elaborate ballet since 2020. As we stood in the middle of First Avenue, which had been turned into a veritable fortress, "There are lots of police departments with dignitary teams." But ours is scalable, He said of the 60-person unit that every September balloons into the hundreds. Nobody has this size or level of integration and planning. Well, the Met, meaning the Metropolitan Police in London, has the royal family and all, so that's something. As Ingle and I chatted outside UN headquarters, Biden had just finished speaking. Due to the recent attempts on Trump's life, law enforcement officials were leading from the front. Weiner, Ronald Rowe Jr., the acting director of the Secret Service, and senior FBI brass stood a few feet away while heavily armed detachments roamed the plaza. In the distance, a Coast Guard cutter and NYPD counterassault teams on fast boats patrolled the East River. At that moment, the UN seemed the safest place on earth and the biggest bullseye. Though the cadence had increased, the mission set had not. TAPU routinely provides close protection for senior U.S. and foreign officials in coordination with the Secret Service and the State Department's Bureau of Diplomatic Security. And it does so on top of a year-long calendar of high-profile events that include the New York City Marathon, the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, New Year's Eve in Times Square, the St. Patrick's Day Parade, the 4th of July fireworks, the U.S. Open, and in 2024, the World Series. Still, nothing compares to the General Assembly. Like Inauguration Day and the Super Bowl, it is an all-hands occasion for federal, state, and local law enforcement. Visiting dignitaries are classified as high, medium, or low risk, which helps Ingle and his federal partners determine how big a security bubble to place around them. Weiner's deputy, Chief John Hart, tried to put things in perspective. UNGA is always a great concern. But now we're talking about historic times, two wars, two assassination attempts, and an election. Next photo, Gotham Guardian. Weiner in a secure operations center at One Police Plaza in Manhattan. Manhattan was abuzz. Three wartime leaders, Iran's Masoud Pezeshkian, Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu, and Ukraine's Volodymyr Zelensky, had converged on the city. And while Netanyahu was in town, he took the opportunity to call in a rather consequential airstrike, eliminating Hezbollah's Secretary General Hassan Nasrallah, a close Iranian ally. Referring to the potential threats amid the flurry of limos, Weiner said, "You never know what'll show up on your bingo card at UNGA." Some of the uncertainty stems from the fact that heads of state arrive with their own bodyguards, who are packing a combustible combination of firearms and diplomatic immunity. Under the 1947 Headquarters Agreement, which established the UN as neutral territory, the U.S. is generally obliged to issue visas and facilitate access for member states, even avowed enemies. UNGA tests the limits of this rule, as well as the patience of national security officials. It is one thing when Britain's prime minister travels with an elite protection team. It is quite another when Iran's president is out and about with a phalanx from the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, a U.S.-designated terrorist organization. According to senior law enforcement officials and court records, the IRGC, besides training and equipping a murderer's row of malign actors, Hamas, Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad, PFLP, PMF, and the Houthis among them, has been at work on American soil, orchestrating a series of brazen murder-for-hire schemes to avenge one of their own. In 2020, Major General Qasem Soleimani was killed in a U.S. drone strike approved by Trump. As commander of the group's elite Quds force, Soleimani was the power behind the throne, responsible for maintaining the regime's authoritarian stranglehold at home and overseeing the deadly work of its proxies abroad. His demise sent Tehran into a tailspin, and triggered a qualitative change in doctrine. Iran had long been, as Weiner put it, calibrated and retributive. It responded to a strike against a general or a nuclear scientist by targeting somebody of comparable stature among its enemies. Now, she advised understatedly, the apertures opened a bit. Iran's stateside plotting pushed ICB into overdrive. Together with the FBI's New York field office, Weiner and her unit helped staff and direct the nation's oldest and largest joint terrorism task force, which includes representatives from some 50 other federal, state, and local agencies. Over the last 2 years, increasingly alarming information started coming in, suggesting that hitmen hired by Iran were roaming the five boroughs. "There's this growing intensity and urgency," Weiner said, "of the hunt for these would-be assassins. We felt like we were chasing ghosts." The NYPD would not discuss how or where the intelligence was gleaned. However, filings by federal prosecutors indicate that information was obtained or derived from electronic surveillance conducted pursuant to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Translation: the feds had received the blessing of the top-secret Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court in Washington, D.C., to target individuals who were believed to be Iranian agents. "I did not fully appreciate the extent of Iran's lethal plotting," as Weiner's team calls it, "or the obsession it had become for officials in New York, until I sat in for part of Weiner's morning intelligence briefing during UNGA. 10 people gathered around a conference table at 1PP, and another 20 from various ICB components, along with FBI representatives, piped in on a secure video feed. They covered a number of threats quickly, mostly off the record. Talk then turned to an unusual incident. The previous evening, as the Iranian president's motorcade was en route to JFK Airport to head back home, an IRGC bodyguard had indicated to authorities that he'd left his weapon at his hotel in Midtown. The Iranians requested that their assigned NYPD security detail retrieve it and bring it to their plane before takeoff. That was a non-starter. Instead, officers were dispatched to the hotel room, where they found not only a knockoff Glock with two loaded magazines, but also an encrypted two-way radio bearing the words "property of the IRGC. Eyes went wide around the room as the group considered the meaning and timing of the incident. Shortly thereafter, as I drove with Weiner to base camp for UNGA operations, Netanyahu's heavily armed convoy whizzed by in the opposite direction. She didn't miss a beat, wondering aloud, imagine if the IRGC guy killed somebody. That would have been a big deal. Her team had turned the gun and radio over to the FBI. "When I revisited the topic with her later," she said, "we are worried about them killing Trump at the same time that we're also being called up from a car and asked to return their property. As my 9-year-old would say, it's very ironical." Hours after the intelligence briefing, and in a seemingly unrelated development, officials in Washington announced a $20 million reward for information leading to the arrest or conviction of an IRGC operative, Shahram Poursafi, who, according to the FBI, used encrypted internet-based messaging applications to hire criminal elements within the United States to murder a former USG official in Washington, D.C., or Maryland, in exchange for $300,000. John Bolton, Trump's former national security advisor, was the unnamed target. But, as I would come to learn, he was hardly the only one. In January, during his first week in office, Trump reportedly ordered that security details be rescinded for Bolton, ex-Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and Pompeo's former deputy Brian Hook. even in the face of apparently ongoing Iranian threats. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.